Petersfield's Shine Radio.
Hello!
Hello! It's Drinking with Phil and Mangs.
And this time, bumper edition.
Absolutely. So because it's the summer, July and August, and we're doing various things like travelling and lots of different things like that, we're doing a combined edition, so you'll have to put up with the same content for 2 months, I'm afraid.
Just listen to the back catalogue at shineradio.uk.
There are some bangers in there, so you could do that, absolutely. What have we got this month then, Phil?
We have got shed loads of wine news to talk about this month.
We have. It's been really interesting. The WhatsApp has been hot with gossip.
And I'm going to say a little bit about the Rhône as our region of the month.
And I've got some summer cocktails.
Ooh, well, let's get on with it then. Come
absolutely.
On.
Absolutely.
OK, let's talk about the Rhône. Big river, starts in Switzerland, runs all the way down through the south of France, over on the eastern side, and pops out in the Med.
Lovely.
Now, if we're talking about Rhône as a wine region, we're really talking about two regions. So we've got the northern Rhône, where everything's really dead expensive, but quite nice.
Yes.
And made with Syrah.
Yeah.
And there's a few other grapes around
the
place,
grape,
but that's the dominant grape. And as you pass Hermitage, kind of
halfway
down-ish.
Yeah, and it's starting to get a bit less hilly at this point.
Getting less hilly, we find ourselves heading towards Avignon.
Nice place to head towards.
It is. And as we get there, we start to become southern Rhône.
We do.
And where the north, it's all about the slopes. In the south, it's all about the galets, the big pebbles, the big pebbles that reflect the heat back up.
Yes.
So your sophistication is up in the north, and your value and your yumminess tends to be down in the south. And in the middle, you've got Avignon.
Yeah.
And what wine do we drink there?
Deliciousness.
It is Châteauneuf du Pape.
We do. It is deliciousness.
It's the church. He's got in on the act again.
It is, but we're talking about Northern Rhône, are we not, just this time, or are we going to talk about Southern Rhône?
Well,
separately. Are you doing it
all together? I don't know. What do you want to do? Well, tell you what, let's just do Northern this time.
Yes.
We'll go down as far as...
there's quite a difference.
Châteauneuf du Pape. They are really very different. And when you talk about Rhône, you have to say which bit of Rhône you're talking about, because they are different.
Yeah.
The climate is different. The geology is different. The growing techniques are different. The grapes are different. The prices are different.
The price is significantly different. The history is really different as well, because a lot of those terraces in the northern Rhône were put in by the Romans.
Well, the Romans and before them, the Greeks.
Well, yeah, the Phoenicians, yeah.
Up in the north, then, our mainstay is Syrah. Syrah, same grape as Shiraz. And there's been a lot of stuff talked about, where did Syrah come from? And there is a place called Shiraz. And I said, oh, it must have come from Shiraz.
No,
it didn't.
No, you can't drink Shiraz in Shiraz either, Phil, much to my disappointment.
We've had that conversation. Listen to the back catalogue. Then you've got people who say, oh, well, it was the Phoenicians. They brought it with them. And there's all sorts of ideas about who brought it. But DNA analysis says... it's a Rhône grape because it came from two absolute unknowns of the grape world, which crossbred and produced the wonderful Syrah. And it is actually quite an ancient grape.
It is. And this is what's really interesting, because it's like most grapes are like natural crosses or something. It's only really recently we started to make them, you know, hybridise
force them into it.
Most things have just been like wildly growing naturally.
And doing their own thing.
Yeah.
So Syrah is the grape, and up in the northern Rhône, we're talking about some of the names that you will have heard, you know, names of wine myth. You've got Côte Rôti, Condrieu, Saint-Joseph?
Yeah, Saint-Joseph. You've got, the one with the windmill. I can't never remember.
You're not thinking of Moulin Rouge, no?
No, I'm not thinking of the Moulin Rouge, no.
Beaujolais, Moulin.
No, I'm not thinking about Moulin or anything like that. My gosh.
You see, I put you on the spot. A French wine scholar, and I put you on the spot. About 2 weeks ago, you knew all of these.
2 weeks ago, I would have known all of these, absolutely. Chateau Grillet, which is one of the big famous ones, which is the highest one. And you go down, and then you've got the Hermitage, Crow's Hermitage and Hermitage, Cornas.
Yes.
Saint-Péray.
Now, there is... It's not all Syrah. There's a little bit of Viognier growing here. And in particular, the Northern Rhone have this technique of blending about 3% Viognier with their Syrah to make it really silky and smooth and... Mm. Oh, really, really good. As you come further south and you move away from the absolute prime spots, the named places, the named almost down to rows of vines and those steep slopes, you know, the favoured curves of the river, you eventually find yourself in Hermitage. And Hermitage is a good starting point for if you're going to start drinking Syrah from the Rhone. It's a little bit more affordable, and more affordable still if you go for Crow's Hermitage, and particularly from Tain. There's a cooperative in Tain, T-A-I-N.
Yep.
And that's a marvellous place for starting your journey with Rhone Syrah, I think.
Yeah, okay. Are you including in the... Because different people account for this differently. The Diois area, the Claret, because there's a little pocket just as an adjunct on the left-hand side, sort of between the north and the south.
Well, there's been a lot of argument over geography in this region. And, there is a sideshow of Claret. And there are two... and now we've gone into white wine.
Yes. All of a sudden, it's like all of a sudden, white.
It could not be more different.
No, totally.
Because you've got Claret de Die, which is a fizzy wine generally made in the ancestral style.
Yes.
So is it a double fermentation? Is it a single fermentation? It's a fermentation which just carries on in the bottle.
Yes.
And is quite sweet.
Yes, yeah, it can be,
Generally a little lower in alcohol than your champagnes. There's no adding sugar or expedition liquor at the end. And there's, what's it called? The slightly drier version of that. Crémant de Die, which is the drier version.
Yeah.
And again, if you like fizzy wine and you like France, practically every region has got a fizz of one sort or another.
Yeah.
And if you're in the Northern Rhone and you've just had too much of the red wine, have a Crémant or a Claret de Die.
Yeah.
Wonderful stuff.
Yes, really, really nice. If you, it's not always that easy to find it in the UK, so if you do see it, have a go, because it's much, much more common and much more popular in France itself.
And if you'd really like to try one, I have actually got one on a tasting I'm doing in August at Gallery 30.
Oh, have you?
Go and look at Gallery 30's website and then come and drink some Rhone wine with me.
Oh, yeah, no, that sounds really good.
Mostly from the Southern Rhone, to be fair.
Yeah.
So, get started with the Rhone, and next time we'll talk about the Southern Rhone. Okay, so what about a bit of wine news?
Yeah, well, you've got some interesting stuff, Phil. There's been some judging at the London Wine Fair, hasn't there?
Yes. Quite recently, London International Wine Fair, they had a big competition trying to emulate what was famously the Judgment of Paris, where the New World and the Old World fought it out with fisticuffs and glasses of wine. So they've recreated that, and they've stacked up wines from the New World against wines from the Old World. Now, who do you think won?
Well, I am, despite my recent sojourn into France, I'm still very much a New World girl, so I'm going to stick my pin in the map of the New World.
You're putting a shilling on that, are you?
I am, yeah.
You just lost a shilling.
Oh, no.
But only just!
Yeah.
So, by the time they had totted up all of the scores, the difference was
0.65%. Wow.
That's how much Old World won by.
That's a tiny fraction. They must be turning in their grave.
Some of the top-scoring wines, though. Best White, Pegasus Bay Riesling, from New Zealand.
Oh, wow. Yum, yum. Yeah.
Runner-up white, Polish Hill Riesling.
Oh, well, now I like a Polish... I love a bit of that Grosso Polish Hill. Really tasty stuff.
But what was the top red wine? Now, you may think we just throw this programme together, but listen up. It was Hermitage Rouge from Jean-Louis Chabet in the Rhone, the 2012 vintage.
Oh, a good vintage. Yeah, yeah, totally.
Good year.
It was a good year, totally.
Beyond my price bracket, but I'm sure they enjoyed
it. Yeah, I would enjoy
and
that on a tasting.
Again, the runner-up red.
Yeah.
The French still rule the reds. It was Chateau Mouton Rothschild Pauillac.
Okay.
And Pauillac is my favourite.
Bordeaux. Okay. So that's a really interesting split then. The whites from the new world have beat the reds from the old world hand down.
Yeah. But across the board, hardly anything in it.
No. How interesting. Ooh, so, I wonder who's going to do what to try and win it next year. a tight run race.
Anyway, what else have we been hearing about? Ooh, tell us about the zebras.
Yeah, this one made me laugh because zebra striping is a thing. I did not know that zebra striping was
this
a thing.
This isn't where you go out with a pot of paint and find a white horse and
No, it's not. Zebra striping is the term that has been embraced by whom, I'm not entirely sure. I think the drinks industry. And it's where you reduce your alcohol intake by having one alcoholic drink and alternating with a non-alcoholic drink, which is a very sensible approach that quite a lot of people have been taking for probably quite some time, but has now been given a funky name. So that you can go out and say, I'm zebra striping tonight. Everybody will ask you what you mean, and you can just say you're alternating. But it's about a quarter of adults in the UK minimise their drinking and manage and control their drinking by doing that. I think it's just a really sensible approach.
Well, yes, but it's just giving something old a new name because what we have always said is one glass of wine, one glass of water.
One of water, one of wine in the morning, you'll be just fine. Yep.
And water, as far as I know, is a non-alcoholic drink.
Well, it is, absolutely. But, you know, we like to do a survey, don't we? And we like to reinvent things. But it's called zebra striping, Phil.
Okay, well...
Also, if I have zebra striped pyjamas, I could just be drinking in those. So, you know, yeah.
As we always say, less but better. What else have we got? Well, let's talk about the UK wine industry. Now, people maybe have the perception that this is quite a marginal thing, despite the fact that we keep talking about it. Well, 2022, which is the latest figures, it was worth to the country £76 billion. That's their contribution to the economy. That's up from 5 years previous, it was £49 billion. So that gives you a clue as to just how quickly the English wine industry is growing.
Mm.
Absolutely incredible.
It's huge.
Brilliant for the exports as well.
Mm.
But, golly, where do we win hands down? Well, not quite win. We are the second biggest importer of wine in the world.
No.
We are importing, 2022 figures again, 1.7 billion bottles of wine equivalent of.
Oh my gosh.
And I tell you
and
what.
And that's just me, Phil.
Some people aren't keeping their end up.
No. Well, my goodness gracious me, that is a lot of bottles. Is that something we should be proud of, though, that we're the second biggest importer of wine? Or is that just a testament to the fact that our wine industry is still in its youth?
I think it's a balance between the two because we've been growing the wine culture for quite a long time, but we only really kicked it off kind of late 70s, early 80s, and it was quite a slow burn. But with zebra striping, who knows what that figure's going to look like in another 5 years' time.
Interesting.
But as ever, let's have good quality.
Mm.
Let's have something to be enjoyed, to be savoured, to be contemplated, and not just drunk, in either sense of the word.
No, absolutely. I think that's really interesting.
Speaking of zebras, what other animals have we got?
It's not really zebras. This tickled me and touched me because, as you well know, Phil, I am a lover of history.
Indeed.
And all things history and a bit of archaeology. And there's a lovely, lovely man in Austria who has been digging about in his wine cellar, and he's not been finding vintage red or he's not been finding vintage white, but he's been finding mammoth bones.
Mammoth bones in his wine cellar. Was the mammoth trying to steal his wine?
I don't think so. I think strongly suspect the mammoth has been there a lot longer than the wine cellar. And he's just been digging down and he's had to report it. But there's at least three Stone Age mammoths in his cellar. And he was renovating when he made the discovery. So
I can feel a marketing campaign coming on.
Yeah, so you're going to call it like mammoth wine and all this kind of stuff. But he thought it was just a piece of wood that had been left there and he dug about and he discovered it all. And there's some beautiful pictures if you go for a Google around this of him digging in his cellar. It's absolutely fabulous. It's just that's the kind of thing that would fill my heart with joy. Wine and excavations. It's just that would make me beyond happy.
I know some archaeologists. They're up for a glass of tea.
Yeah, totally. They are. Absolutely. And then the other thing that touched me completely the other end of the spectrum is just the joy that goes into drinking that many, many people have and how it can often lead to expedient changes in wine rules. Because currently in Italy, the DOC that's around Lake Garda has got quite strict rules about how you can produce wine and where you can produce wine.
Rightly so.
Absolutely. It's a premium quality product and all the rest of it. But they're rather led by a lot of very rich and famous people who go out on the lake and are struggling with bottles and who would like to put it in cans. And so they are considering that it might be all right to put some premium wine in cans so that the rich and famous people can drink it while they're floating about on Lake Garda. So I'm like, your wine rules can be led by consumer demand.
Our old friend Simon Hawkins has always maintained that you can put quality wine in cans.
You can, absolutely.
And indeed, if you're going to can your wine does need to be designed for the can.
Yes. So they're going to have to change some production.
You don't rot the insides of the can. And
Totally.
End up with something horrible.
So it is, that's why you have to think about it in terms of the wine rules and things like that. They're not just being precious, going, you have to put it in a bottle. Sorry, that's French, isn't it? Not Italian.
Well, the Italians have got a track record here because when we all started drinking Prosecco, they looked at the Prosecco growing area and went,
we're never going to
keep
up with
it. It's too small. They just massively expanded it.
Yes, absolutely. And the quality of the product
has suffered
somewhat with it,
in my opinion. If you want good Prosecco, DOCG is what you should be looking for.
Yes, absolutely. It is, yes.
Valdabione.
Right, well, there we are. I think that's enough wine news, isn't it?
I think that's quite a romper and some interesting little bits and pieces. We like to keep things light.
You're listening to Drinking with Phil and Mags on Petersfield's Shine Radio. One of the things which came as a kind of added benefit to doing the WSET beer was I got signed on as a WSET student.
Hurrah!
Which meant I got an invitation to a lovely wine tasting in London. I thought,
oh, nice.
Oh, I've not been up in town for a bit and it seems like a good reason.
Mm.
So I got myself a ticket and along I went to a tiny, tiny little region down in the foot of Italy called Ciro, which I'd never heard of before.
No.
And tried some of their wine. Have a listen. So I find myself in London on Pall Mall at a tasting for Ciro Revolution, which is a consortium of growers who are trying to preserve the traditional grapes, the traditional values of this little region way down in the south of Italy. Not a region I'm particularly familiar with, and they're really promoting a grape that I'm not familiar with, which is Gallioppo. I'm actually speaking with Ewan Proctor from
Inotria. Be fastidious on the name, because funnily enough, before it was known as Ciro, the region, in antiquity it was actually known as Inotria, which means the land of wine. And it was one of the oldest regions for producing grapes in the Mediterranean. And just to give people an idea of where it is, if you look at the boot, it's the ball of the foot. So it's that point at which Calabria starts to move, instead of being more east-west along the coastline, it starts to turn a corner and move a little bit north. And it's got this lovely microclimate there. And that's where you find the Gallioppo grape.
And all of the growers I've spoken to so far have been a matter of hundreds of metres from the coast, if that.
Yeah, actually, with Vumbaca, they actually grow their vines in two areas. And it's probably the best way to describe the region is that there's two main growing areas. One is Tiro Marina, which is where it probably been tasting from. Sandier soils, very close to the coast. But Tiro is actually a town. It's up on the, what they said, a colina, like the little hills. Not super high. We're talking 100 to 150 metres, but a different soil type up there. So less sandy, more clay, and what they call calcaric, also like limestones as well. Clay over a limestone base, which is classic winemaking terroir.
And tell us who you're working with here today, because there is one particular winemaker you're working with.
Yep, so we're very fortunate to import Vumbaka, Vignetti Vumbaka. Winemakers here right next to me, Christian, who I've essentially translating for today. And yeah, he has four wines on tasting. He has an amazing white wine that's made from the white grape of the region called Greco Bianco. Then Rosato, which is a really sort of astounding color made from Gallopo, but grown at Tiro Marina on the sandy soils. Whereas his two reds, there's Classico Superiore, which is from up on the hill, older vines, the bush vines, in fact. And then a Superiore Reserva. So the Reserva is just means 2 years of aging, and there's no other extra discipline of whether it should be in oak or whatever. It just means that it needs to be 2 years from vintage before it's released in bottle.
Bottle as well. Yeah. So
it's up to the winemaker. It just has to be 2 years. Yeah. To be Superiore, it has to be at minimum of 13% alcohol. And the Tiro Classico means the classic region of either Tiro or Tiro Marina. Yeah.
And what would you say was the distinctive characteristics of the wines from this region? Why would somebody go out and seek these out?
So I think Gallopo is going, like, gaining some sort of, not instant, but it's really gaining a bit of momentum, because it presents a wine from Calabria, from southern Italy, that is quite actually light in the glass, yet has a beautiful aromatic sort of quality to it. It's not super dense or thick. And it actually has surprising tannin and acidity, but it's not really overpowering. It's quite a medium-bodied wine with quite sort of a natural finesse. And you do get around the room, and I'm sure you'll have a lot of fun, trying some different styles. Whilst the region allows a DOC, and it's the oldest DOC in Calabria, but it does that does allow for quite a wide variety of methods employed to make the wines. Would point out that the Tiro Revolution group only use 100% Gallopo. So whilst in the region you might find sometimes a little bit of a blend of this, there's actually Malvasia Nera present and things like that, but here in the room today, only 100% Gallopo wines for the reds.
And one of the fascinating things is, going around the room, we've got such similarity in the making and the grapes, and yet people are producing wines which are distinctly different.
So I think
some incredibly fragrant and some heading in the direction of austere, but not getting there.
Exactly. And I think it's worth, you know, for the people who are really wine studious, actually having a look at this region, looking at, you know, I love looking at a map or two. It's a fascinating point where, as I mentioned before, the coast turns a bit. It does have a couple of watercourses. It's a sort of an undulating region of lots of different microclimates, and I think that's why people are finding it so interesting, because there is a variety of both of technique, but of also terroir, which is, and by using the same grape, we get lots of different, you know, a spectrum of lots of different styles to enjoy.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for that great introduction.
You're welcome.
Well, that's super interesting, because I've not come across that grape before, and also there's a lot in there in terms of, like, really proper production standards.
It's
like,
absolutely,
you know, really, really varietal and different. And also, I know that you got to talk to the lady who organised the whole thing, so that will be really interesting for us to catch up with that a bit later in the programme.
Coming later. So, Max, we promised people summer cocktails.
We did, Phil.
A light, frivolous little something to drink in the sunshine.
And we're assuming it's going to be sunshine, because so far, thus far, the early summer has been a little
lacklustre, yes.
So I've put together a list which has got a few things on it which could be more warming or more cooling, depending how the rest of the summer goes, Phil. But there are some really delicious...
Is there some mulled ale in here anywhere?
Well, I'll come on to that in just a minute, Phil, because
okay,
you're not far off with one of the cocktails. Let's start with the light cheese spritz. Now, lychee, lovely, lovely. You can get the juice in cans, and that's what we'll need here.
So can you? Just the juice?
You can get lychee juice, yeah.
Oh, God, I need to shop in the better class of store, obviously.
No, you can get it in many different supermarkets. Quite often you'll find it down the World Foods aisle and stuff like that, but there's some really delicious stuff out there,
right.
And lychee juice is much more commonly available. We're going to need some lychee juice, so we're going to need 200 mils of lychee juice. We're going to need just a teaspoon of rose water.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to have a bottle of Prosecco and then top it off with a little bit of soda water to taste. So you're making cocktails here in a jug for you to take out into the garden. Lychee spritz, just mix all of that together. Just give it a nice stir. Really best in a champagne flute, maybe garnish with a raspberry or something like that. It's not too sweet, but it's just really lovely and zingy. And the rose gives it a beautiful aroma that cuts right through and comes out on the palate, but not really strongly, because not everybody likes rose water.
No.
But I really am a bit partial to lychee spritz.
Do you think you could substitute lychee juice with a Gewürztraminer, which famously smells of lychees?
I think that would make it a very different spritz, Phil, but I don't see why you couldn't.
Experiment!
Yeah, totally, but you've got to make up your own cocktails and things like that, haven't you? I'd be prepared to give it a go. But I think, you know, Gewürz is quite sweet, isn't it?
Yeah, it can be, yes.
But I think definitely you could use any kind of juice. I'm guessing you could use pineapple, you could use any of those things. But I think the thing to think about is if you want to put the rose water in, you've got to balance that.
Balance
that.
It's all
flavor.
About the balance.
Here is another one which you may or may not have had. Now, if you're anything like most of the rest of the world, at the back of your cocktail cabinet, you've got a bottle of blue Curacao.
I haven't, actually.
Have you not?
I've got 3 bottles of pastis.
Oh, gosh.
I'm still waiting for the summer to be hot enough to drink any of it.
Well, but anyway, so most people have got the bag ends of a bottle of blue Curacao or something like that, and they're going, what on earth am I going to do with that? This is the cocktail for you to use that on, and it's called a Purple Rain. And it is really rather exceptional and very good. I like. So the quantities for making one drink, 25ml of vodka, 15ml of blue Curacao, 25ml of lime juice, 75ml of grenadine.
Okay.
And then top it off with a little glug of lemonade. Not very much, just a little bit of a glug. Put it in a tall glass over some ice cubes. It is called Purple Rain because it is the most beautiful purple colour. You think about the grenadine that you've got going in there, and you've got the beautiful blue, and it mixes up, and it's really unusual, and it's not too sweet. It's got the lime juice is really cutting through.
That will cut through,
it's zingy, and it's funky, and really a surprise for lots of people.
It sounds to me like the prince of drinks.
It's utterly, utterly delicious, and no, I'm not rising to the bait on that joke. You can take your raspberry beret in your little red Corvette and drive it off out into the sunset. But no, the Purple Rain, honestly, can highly recommend. Did it at a little cocktail do had not long ago, and it went down a storm. Everybody said it was their favourite.
Oh,
interesting.
So there
you go.
Okay.
We go classic. If it's not so hot, you might want something a little bit warming. And in which case, then I'm going to suggest an amaretto sour, which is amaretto, 250ml of amaretto, 250ml of lemon juice.
Okay.
And 750ml of soda water, so it's a nice long drink. If you're not a fan of marzipan, you're not going to like that one, but I am.
Yeah, and,
I like
and
that.
My wife would hate that, but
yeah.
I wouldn't mind it.
Put it over ice, bit of a cherry on a stick. It's a bit of a cherry on a stick cocktail, that one, as far as I'm concerned, because of the amaretto
like
and the glacé cherries are nice. So yeah, get that one down your neck. And if you don't fancy that, you could have, less warming, but you could have a Chambord Bramble. Do you know Chambord?
I do.
The Loire, actually.
Again, not at the back of my cupboard.
But it's a beautiful bottle shaped like an orb. It comes from the Loire, from the Chambord Chateau, where, you know, there's beautiful wine that's going around. Half of gin, half of lemon juice, and half of Chambord.
And that's a framboise, isn't it?
It is. It's black framboise, black raspberry.
Black framboise.
Yeah,
oh,
black raspberry. So that's a really nice one, and you might not have had that. I went for some slightly more unusual ones here. Back to the amaretto, because I am a fan of the amaretto, and I do have a bottle.
And you've got a bottle to use up.
Yeah, totally. One of cognac and one of amaretto. That's called a French Connection. Really simple, very straightforward. I would end the evening on that one.
Yeah, I could go for that.
Yeah, I'd end it.
That sounds my kind of drink.
Very simple. You can have it with ice or without. I quite like it with, but they're really, really elegant to put together. And you asked, Phil, about whether there was a beery cocktail. There is a beery cocktail.
Is there
actually,
now?
There
well,
is a beery cocktail.
Let's have it.
Okay. One shot of sugar syrup, 150ml of golden ale. So you can give us a recommendation
ale, yes.
for us
okay.
in a minute. 150 mils of Prosecco and 75 mils of ginger beer.
Ooh.
Over ice. I've not had that, but I think that sounds really rather tasty and a little bit different, because you've got some golden ale there, you've got a little bit of sugar syrup cutting through it, but you've got that lovely warm gingery spice, which would also, because bear in mind ginger is quite refreshing if it is hot as well, particularly with some ice. You've got a bit of Prosecco in there to give it a bit of lively fizz and zhuzh, but Prosecco isn't strong in its flavour, it's more there for character. And kind of,
I'm seeing that with maybe a slight pairing of ginger just floating on it.
Yes, actually, potato peeler, some crystallised ginger.
Might go a bit sweet then, but
It depends where your palate lies. What would you put if you like Mr. Beer, WSET Beer,
Golden Ale? There's one which used to be produced by the wonderful Horndean Brewery, Gales, which was Oliver's Island. Now, if you see that on a bar, have a go. It's just the perfect summer beer.
Oh, is it? Okay.
A little bit of bitterness. Yeah. Not too heavy on the alcohol. Beautiful golden colour. Oh.
Okay. And then
and
we can
not
that
one
in.
Of these blooming IPAs. I mean, crikey.
IPAs are everywhere.
They're absolutely everywhere. I mean, I like an IPA, but I want to have a choice.
Yeah, a bit of variety. Okay, so let's use that then in our golden ale cocktail, our little ginger beery cocktail. There you go. So that's a bit of a variety
for you. If you try any of those, point in and let us know how you got on.
You're listening to Drinking with Full and Mags on Petersfield Shine Radio. We haven't had a Lost Pubs of Petersfield for a while, Phil.
No, they've been lost.
They have lost
in the cellars.
And you're not even doing your funny jingle anymore. Hurrah.
It was coming.
Are you brewing up to it? Yeah.
But I was going to say, I actually had the opportunity to go down into the cellars of a house in Sheep Street only a couple of days ago. And there's all kinds of mad little bits of arches and, again, tales of tunnels from one to another that go across the square, across the street.
What was going on?
The old end of the street. If you look at Sheep Street now, it actually ended about halfway down in ye olden-y days. And the rest of it has been added on. So there's got to be something in it. I just want there to be something in it. But anyway, here's somebody else who wants there to be something in it. Bill Gosney from Petersfield Museum. A mine of historical information about the town. And, of course, the Lost Pubs of Petersfield. Max is raising her eyebrows in such a degree. So we're continuing the long and involved tale of the Lost Pubs of Petersfield. And previously we've explored the high level, we've been round the square, we've made it down the high street, and today I'm talking with an absolute fount of knowledge, which is Bill Gosney. How are you doing, Bill?
I'm doing okay, Phil.
And Bill, you're a trustee of the museum and also the editor of the Bulletin of the Petersfield Historical Society, an all-round Petersfield history nerd.
I don't know about nerd, but I know a few things about history.
So today we're going to explore a little bit beyond the high street, but we've just been talking about some fascinating, very early aspects of, I suppose, the genesis of pubs and their regulation. So tell me a little bit about the lady in the back room brewing the beer.
Before brewers, or we know them today, massive brewers, beer was actually brewed locally by the housewife, and she would make enough for herself. She would sell the surplus by putting out a sign or an ale wand.
An ale wand?
And typically evergreen, such as ivy and a pole, say that she had beer for sale. And so this could be called the origination of the pub sign.
So effectively, we've got a sort of beer fairy with her ale wand.
The actual change, if you want, from the sign being put outside the ale wand into more of a sign was in 1383, when Richard II compelled landlords to erect a sign outside their premises. So they had to do away with the holly or the ivy put outside, And the legislation they put said, well, whoever shall brew ale in the town with the intention of selling it must hang out a sign, otherwise he shall forfeit his ale. And this was the strength, and this was also the strength of the ale that could be tested.
Ah, and you were telling me also that there was a specific civic position of ale testers. Well, so I love the way they test the beer. This
well,
is great.
It wasn't just that. They tested, the medieval system tested weights of loaves and also the strength of beer. And if you want, you might have called it the weights and measures man of old. And he would come into the pub with leather trousers on. And he would take some beer and he would pour it on his wooden stool and he would sit on it. And when he got up, if it stuck to him, he would consider that it was the right strength. So that's what it's called, an ale conner.
So if you're in a pub and you find it's all a bit sticky, that's actually a good sign, not a bad sign.
Well, I'm sure many of us have felt stickiness on our feet from standing in piles of beer, yeah.
Anyway, after that little introduction, I've promised that we can take people down to the Spain, because at the moment, you know, today, the Spain is a very calm, peaceful, residential area. Looks very sweet and sedate. But back in the day, there were a number of pubs on the Spain, weren't there?
The Spain is an interesting part of Petersfield, and it may, just may, be older than the main town. Certainly, they believe that it was certainly there at the formation of the town. And the houses in that area are the oldest in the town. And the recent big dig they've had in Petersfield verifies this from the finds that there is at least medieval or maybe older. So it's an old part of the town. Although the Normans, in fact, set out this town as a new town. It could well be, and it's now thought it quite possible that the Spain was already there, or land a bit further on. So it's an ancient part of the town. And over the years, it had, we know, for instance, that they had overflow from the market. The sheep were auctioned there occasionally. Horse fairs were there before they went to the heath in the 1800s. So an important part of the town. So because of this importance, as always happened, people around there, and pubs sprung up, and there have been three or four pubs in that area, and they all have different history. One probably has the most gruesome history of any pub in the town. Others were shut down because they were too rowdy. As in cases of all the pubs in Petersfield, they evolve and they change because of market forces. How the economy and how the trend of that part of Asian history was depended where a pub was. But certainly there were three or four pubs there.
Well, I can't resist gruesome. So tell me about the gruesome pub history in Spain.
It was called the Spain Arms. It was built in 1777 and it actually stayed there to 1909. Today, if you look at it, it's called Number One the Spain and it's a guest house.
Oh.
It was called, originally, it was known to have borne the sign of the shoulder of mutton and the cauliflower, from different names it had. But it may not have always been an inn. It might have been just a place that sold beer on its own. But certainly by 1911, it was known as the Spain Arms.
Mm-hmm.
At this time, it got a reputation. It was not only a pub, but it had 18 lodgers, including some Italians, one of which was an organ grinder. And in 1904, the Italians got into a fight with Mr. Campbell, who was a local man, and during which he was hit on the head with an organ stick.
An organ stick?
An organ stick and a cobbler's iron.
Oh, well, I think that would do some damage.
Which fractured his skull, Phil, you're right there. And the landlord sent him to the workhouse to be cared for, but he died a few days later.
Oh.
Meanwhile, the Italian workmen had disappeared, not surprisingly, but they were tracked down, and the case finally came to Winchester Assizes in 1907, which was 3 years after the murder took place. And by this time, basically, no one could recognise more positively identify him, so he got off.
Grizzly goings on in Spain.
But if you want, fate catches up with the pub, because in 1909, drunkenness throughout Britain was becoming a problem with rowdiness. Petersfield was no exception. And in 1909, the local authority were given permission to close a certain number of pubs to reduce the amount of drinking houses, and that pub, the Spain Arms, was one that was closed.
Ah.
So from 1909, it's not in there.
And so it quietened down. Yeah.
And the other one that closed in the town would be the Swan. And the Swan is where today we have the Nationwide Building Society. And
okay, yes.
That was knocked down. The pub was in 1909, and they built a cinema called the Electric Theatre on the site. But they did retain to the road that went up the side, the pub, the one that we now would call Swan Street. It was named after the pub that disappeared there.
Ah, so it's still commemorated in the
Still commemorated. And interestingly, the museum has the pub sign, which obviously must have come through the Historical Society who gave their artefacts to the museum, but it was painted, I always remember looking at this, in 1909. So not only had just finished painting the sign, and the council closed the pub.
Oh. And would you believe, there's still more of that to come.
Oh, the many,
on
another
many program.
Pubs that will not remain lost. Yeah.
Now, before we say cheerio to Chiro, I did get to speak to the lady, an absolute dynamo, who organised this whole tasting, brought producers across, brought all the wine across, got a room full of people, and showcased this very little known region. So, little listen to her. I've now got to speak with Juzi, who is one of the flag bearers for Chiro Revolution, helping them to break through into these wider markets. Hi, Juzi. How do you think it's going today?
I think it's brilliant. I'm really happy that I can see lots of people coming over here, tasting the wines, getting to know the producers, and ultimately getting to know a region which has been left on the side for a long time. So now it's our return, revamp of the origin, let's say.
Given that Chiro was one of the earliest PDOs in Calabria, I think perhaps the earliest, how is it that they now need a leg up to introduce themselves to the market? What's changed?
Calabria, as we know, has been making wines for 3,000 years. We used to be called Enotria, the land of wine, but for too long it has been neglected due to different, you know, reasons like economic depression and difficulties in marketing themselves. Luckily, 10 years ago, a group of young producers in Chiro decided it was time to change the sort and the fortune of this area. And they started the Chiro Revolution movement, where they tried and they managed in the end to exalt the pure essence of the local grape varieties like Gaglioppo and Greco Bianco. Now, they were fighting against the DOC appellation of Chiro, which allows the blend and the use of other grape varieties other than local, like, for example, international grape varieties or other Italian grape varieties like Barbera, Sangiovese, Cabernet Sauvignon, which is, you know, grown in the area, and other international varieties like Chardonnay. But this group of producers realized the importance of bringing back the essence of the Gaglioppo grape by using only the local grape, 100%, and avoiding or trying to control the impact of the wood. So most of the wines today are made with natural ferments or wild yeasts, no use wood at all, unless in some, you know, exceptional cases, but where the wood is anywhere controlled in terms of not impacted much on the wine. Therefore, the wines are fermented and then aged in cement tanks, stainless steel tank or bottle. There is lots of interest in bottle aging, which in fact is the right way to kind of enhance the grape variety of the Gaglioppo. Gaglioppo is a very difficult grape variety. It's very difficult to manage. It's very difficult to tame. So the prolonged, how can I say, rest in tanks and in bottle will bring out the best of it. When you try to use the wood, what do? You just cover the real taste of the grape, you end up with a wine which is not expressing itself in the right way. You can see from the color of the bottles that Gaglioppo tends to be the kind of almost brownish garnet color, because it's originally a light in color, and it has a very big quantity of tannins. That's why it was used in the past to boost the tannins of the Nebbiolo, and hence the name of the Barolo of the South. Many Barolo producers admitted to me personally that Gaglioppo is not their enemy, but their friend, because he helped to help making good wines in the past. So that's the role of the Gaglioppo grape. And today this group is managing to revamp the image of the real Ciro, fighting against the DOC, which wants and permits the use of international varieties.
But fighting the DOC from the inside.
Yes, because that's why it's a revolutionary group.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, there is no, how can I say, conflict with the big wineries, the big brands who tend to use Merlot, Cabernet, the blends, because of course they have to produce more bottles and to sell more. But what they want to do, there is a synergy there, because the small group of the revolution, the Ciro Revolution people, are helping to raise the bar of the Gaglioppo. But the big wineries, they sell already in the world before them. They are helped also by this producer. So there is a kind of a synergy there between the two. So they are not in conflict.
How many producers have we got here today?
We have 11 producers, all belonging to the group. The good thing about them is that they taste. It's one of the few cases in Calabria where people get together, because Calabria in the south in general, there is lots of envy, there is lots of contrast. They have managed to realize the importance of being united to fight against the world. So that's why they taste together, they help each other, they confront themselves with ideas on winemaking. So that's a positive point.
With that description of the group, I'm surprised to find that everybody has got their own small winery operation. They haven't gone down the cooperative route that so many people with smaller vineyards and smaller productions tend to do. Why is that? Or do you think that's something that may come in the future?
I don't think it will, because still they want to keep the individuality of the group. Most of the vineyards, of course, belong to their fathers, and somehow, because they are starting to sell more, not just locally, but also outside, they are starting to get money to buy new machinery and to create also winemaking facilities when they don't have it. Now, of course, between them, they help each other. There are some producers who use facilities of other winemakers of the group, so there is that kind of a help. But the co-op is not a big thing in the south of Italy. It's more northern Italian kind of thing. We are very parochialist, unfortunately, in the south, so we like to keep our things close to us, and especially Calabria. So I'm Calabria myself, so we tend to keep everything for ourselves.
It's a cultural individuality.
Yes, it's a cultural thing rather than, you know, a social thing.
So if people are turned on by what we've been talking about today and want to try these wonderful wines, where will they be able to get hold of them?
Right. 5 out of the 11 producers are already imported in the UK. 5 of them are already in the UK. And I'm glad to see many of these wines in the lists of sommelier wine lists. Many sommeliers in London are Calabrian, so that's a kind of a pride moment for them to have the wines in the wine list. The other 6 are looking for representation. So the idea behind the event today is kind of twofold. I've organized this event, one, because I wanted them to break through and try to let them go outside and sell the wines outside Calabrian or Italian borders. So for those who are already imported, this is a way of putting the wines under the nose of sommeliers so that they can taste and buy the wines. For those who are not imported, then it's a way for distributors who don't have Calabrian wine lists on their portfolio list to try and list some of these wines. And in fact, this evening, myself putting together a small group of non-imported producers, so the 6 of them, and I'm trying to match them with a small group of distributors to see if I can marry them.
You're a matchmaker
Yes, I'm trying to do that, because the others don't need more help than just doing tastings, because the wines are already available on the UK market.
Brilliant. Well, Juicy, I hope you're very successful with that, and if there are any wine angels listening to this, get in touch.
Thank you so much, Philip. Thanks a lot.
So there we are. If you're a wine angel, email us team@shineradio.uk.
I'm an angel, but I don't think they're the kind that you're looking for, Phil.
Okay,
What about some drinking days to see us through the summer months?
We have got a combination for July and August. We're going to keep quite busy with a bit of variety. So it's funny we've just talked about cocktails because there's quite a few that come up here. On the 2nd of July, we've got Annie's Set Day. On the 10th, we've got Pina Colada Day.
Pina Coladas!
It's a classic summer cocktail. I didn't give you the recipe for that because you'll know where to go and find it and be able to make one for yourself. Same for on the 11th, it's Mojito Day.
Oh, I remember that from last year.
Oh, mojitos. Many, many delicious types of mojito that you can make. On the 12th, it's Michelada Day, which is a Mexican beer with lime juice. So it's just classic Mexican cerveza with lime juice and spices added to it, which sounds really rather nice, Mexican spices.
So it's not just lager and lime.
No, it's not just lager and lime. There's spice in there as well, which sounds really delicious. 13th of July, it's Rum Day. 14th, it's Grand Marnier Day. Now, I don't associate Grand Marnier with being particularly summery. But if we're on the theme of cocktails, it's a good mixer.
Yeah, okay.
You know, it's going to give you a lot of flavour, isn't it? 19th, classic cocktail. Get your shakers out. It's Daiquiri Day.
Daiquiri Day.
It is, absolutely. And we can follow that on the 24th with Tequila Day. and the 25th is not to be outdone and outshone by tequila. It's Mezcal Day.
Ah, well, tequila, of course. Blue agave.
Mm-hmm.
Mezcal. All kinds of things.
All kinds of agave.
All kinds
yes,
of
absolutely.
Things.
I went to a mezcal when I was in Mexico. I went to a mezcal factory / production site. It's terribly interesting to watch it all happening. Basically, they cook the giant, like they like giant pineapples, and they're cooked and cooked and cooked and pulped.
Yeah.
And the resulting, I was not a fan to start with. I have become a bit of a mezcal fiend. It's gorgeous stuff.
Is mezcal the one they put the worm in?
No, that's tequila.
Is it?
It is.
Oh, okay.
Mezcal is just like so smoky. And I would say, yes, really smoky, that you almost can't taste anything else. But it's a really, when you get used to that, it's a really rich and beautiful smoke. It's really, really tasty. I could get into a lot of trouble with mezcal. Tequila, me, on the other hand, have a very poor history. On the 1st of August, you mentioned just earlier on that you didn't like this so much, but it's IPA Beer Day.
Well, I do like it a lot. I just like
the
beer choice.
Yes, absolutely. All right, but that leads up to your choice then. On the 2nd of August, it's International Beer Day, Phil.
Ah, that's
my
day.
One we can all embrace. After all those cocktails and spirits, we can just have a night off on some lovely light ale of some description.
Hopefully by then, WSET will have sent me my badge, which I can wear with pride.
Oh, yes. I got my badge as well.
Oh, you've got your badge?
I finally got my certificate.
Why aren't you
wearing it?
And my
little badge one. I'm wearing it because it's on my pin board, Phil, so I don't lose it.
Oh, bless.
Absolutely. I did take a picture of it. And we have got, on the 18th of August, we have got Pinot Noir Day. Nice, elegant, lovely wine, whether it's from France or whether
Pinot
it's
Noir.
From... I love a bit of New Zealand Pinot Noir.
Well, Central Otago, that's the place I always recommend people to go to.
And there is
they
particularly...
beautiful, beautiful wine.
Western Australia, Denmark Hill Pinot Noir.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to set you back a couple of pence. D-Block, very specifically, if you're looking for the named terroir.
Yes, I've heard of that.
Yeah, and this is really rather good stuff. So, 25th, Whiskey Sour Day. Back to the cocktails.
Mm-hmm.
Not my favourite. But 30th, Mai Tai Day. So we're going to end the summer, end of August, on a little Mai Tai.
Well, hopefully by then, at least we've had a bit of sunshine on our skin.
Well, we've got lots of options within there and within the cocktails that we've recipes that we've given you. So keep you satisfied for a couple of months. So hopefully you'll find one that you like.
Okay, so Mags, I've talked about the Northern Rhone. It's up to you now to come up with a nice recommendation for the listeners.
And I have got a lovely recommendation for the listeners because I've thought long and hard about this. I've suffered for the art, so
oh,
you don't
bless.
Have to. Northern Rhone, as you've expressed, is some of the most expensive wine that you will get outside of, like, you know, going up to the Bourgogne and stuff like that. There's some really seriously expensive. But Crow's Hermitage is the most accessible way to get into Northern Rhone wine and taste the classic expression. So in Marks and Sparks, in Marks and Spencer's,
uh-huh.
for £15, you can get a Northern Rhone Crow's Hermitage, which is a really lovely cinnamon, black pepper, berries, classic Syrah profile, very elegant, long on the finish. Would be suitable for having maybe with a little bit of a barbecue if you're having a lot of meaty stuff on your barbecue. Not so much maybe for the, you know, lighter things like salads and vegetarian things, but really, really delicious. Blends up to 15% of Marzan, in the Crows Hermitage in this particular variety. But in Crows Hermitage is the largest production, so it's the biggest production area in the Northern Rhone. So you will find a few more of these. But the wines are typically the profile that comes through. They're aged in beton, so either concrete or inox stainless steel, or in the fuge, the big wooden casks. What you don't find is them aging in like small casks.
Small
massive. Yeah, they're massive, great big.
No, so it's about smoothing. It's not about bringing flavours to it.
Yeah. And another interesting fun fact of Crows Hermitage, if you're looking at it down on a map, it's one of the only two Appalachians that's on the left bank of the Rhone. And that gives it a slightly different kind of weather profile. So you get slightly different flavours and things like that coming out from the grapes. But £15, Marks and Spencer's, get yourself a Crows Hermitage. So £15 might be a little bit, you know.
Oh, it's a,
but it's quite.
It's not a weekday wine, but.
No, but it's.
Treat
it's
yourself.
Way more accessible than some of the other options. If you want some treats, then General Wine have got some really lovely Northern Rhones in from the Appalachians. But go in with your eyebrow cocked, because they will cost you some money. So, yeah. So that's why I went with that, because it's a little bit more accessible.
Yeah, good for suggestion.
Them. Yeah.
And that's it. That's it. 2 months have flown by.
They have, absolutely. So what are we going to talk about in September, Phil?
Well, we've got to do Southern Rhone. We've done Northern Rhone.
So
Southern Rhone will just
about...
sulk if we don't talk about
it. Well, absolutely. So why don't I cover off on Southern Rhone, and then you can make a wine recommendation.
You've got loads of wines.
Like Village,
I've got
wine,
a box of them downstairs.
Well, there you go. You can taste your way through all of them to make a recommendation for our lovely listeners.
I'll make the sacrifice.
Thank you. And obviously we'll do drinking days, and we might continue with Lost Pubs of Petersfield.
And, of course, there will be wine news, there will be singing, dancing.
And frivolity generale.
Meanwhile, enjoy your summer.
Absolutely.
And bye for now.
That shine forever.
I'm so in love with you.
Oh, no, no.
And the brightest tunes of today. Great music and local information. Only from Petersfield's Shine Radio.